The next case for this morning is United States v. Yazel. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is again Mr. McGowan, and I represent Mr. Yazel in this case. And
Mr. McGowan, rather than even more rehash, I mean, you're certainly free to say anything you want to about Booker, but I wanted to ask you about the government's argument that Mr. Yazel waived his point about the interpretation of that administrative order, the 2B1.1B7C argument. It sounded like a pretty vague comment to me in the transcript about that.
Your Honor, this is certainly a close call. But I think under the circumstances in the transcript, I think it does amount to an objection, and these are the reasons why. He starts out objecting to the 2 points. And then when he's explaining, defense counsel that is, when he's explaining his objection, that's when it gets a little fuzzy. He's not fuzzy about two of the possible bases for this. However, it's the third one where he trips up a bit.
And don't you think if he had actually in some way indicated to the judge that he thought the Robertson behavior also didn't qualify for the reasons that you've now argued in your brief, the government would have had a chance to make its relevant conduct argument. It would have had a chance to show why a real estate transaction is connected enough to the Merrill Lynch stuff, and you would have had it, you know, the defense counsel would have had a chance to say, no, it isn't. You know, I mean, there would have been some exploration of this issue, and of course, nothing like that happens because no one knows that this is actually a timing point that's being made, or perhaps a relevant conduct point, depending how you want to look at it.
Your Honor is certainly correct, and I found this a very convoluted argument to make. It was difficult for me. Under the guidelines, this was one of the harder arguments that I've actually worked on. And yes, if it had been all up front, if it had been writing, it would have been, of course, much better. If it had been, it would have been better. It could have been a lot better. However, the question really is whether he made the objection at all. The government's argument that he sort of conceded the third basis for this. And even in this guideline regime, if you make the argument at all, if you make the objection at all, that before the sentence is imposed, that can be preserved.
But don't you think that means somehow alerting the court to the basis? As I read this excerpt, it seems to me he's saying, well, you shouldn't apply this enhancement based on Robertson because it's only one time and there's some sort of state remedy for the Robertson behavior. Securities Commissioner's office could pursue it on its own. You know, that kind of alternative way of punishing him almost for that behavior. I just don't get a glimmer of the it's too far removed or after in time or anything like that.
The only argument I really have is that he ends his argument with there aren't three instances, and he didn't say there are two instances that don't count there, but not three. He says there aren't three, and
right.
One of the various interpretations of that can be there aren't any violations. And when you tie that with the original objection, I object to the 2 points, which was kind of thrown out there, I admit.
Okay.
But you tie it into the judge's actually, to the extent that he addressed it, ruling on it, without saying the judge didn't say, oh, you admit the third one. Okay, so I'm not going to address that. I think it's been preserved. Now, one comment about the Howard case. The government argues that it's distinguishable because it's talking about something other than relevant conduct, and I admit that the Howard opinion doesn't talk about relevant conduct per se. However, it is factually the same as this case, and it has to be relevant conduct that it's referring to. Otherwise, the imposition of the two levels wouldn't have applied because it had nothing to do with the offense of conviction. And I have argued at length about Booker. I don't intend to repeat those arguments.
Don't have anything new after hearing
nothing really new other than there is an interesting point that a new Sixth Circuit opinion made on the
another one yet.
Yet another Sixth Circuit
on the third prong of plain error, and that was that Alano may indicate that there are some forms of errors that are very difficult for defendants to prove that there's been a problem. I mean, it has affected their substantial right that should be presumed prejudicial. And with that, Your Honors, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. L.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Stephen Elke. I'm an assistant U.S. attorney with the Western District, and I was one of the counsel below. There was waiver in this case, and the court need only look at one page at the sentencing hearing. Well, look at more than that, but one page makes it crystal clear, and that's Record 71 at page 26. Counsel says, we have looked at the issue of the add-on for the violation of state administrative order, and the evidence that was attached to at least two of those did not constitute a violation. That sentence is important for a number of reasons. First of all, it's after Judge Shabazz and after the PSR writer had indicated that the two-point add-on was coming. In other words, they knew that this was out there as a potential sentencing enhancement factor. And counsel specifically says, and this goes to the knowledge in terms of an intentional relinquishment of a right, which is, of course, required for waiver, he says, we have looked at it. So he's acknowledging he knows about it. And then he says, at least two of those did not constitute a violation. Further down on that same page 26, he says, the third one on Robertson, there is information supplied in the pre-sentence report where he talks about the offer and the sale of a security. I would not dispute that. But that is only one instance of an alleged violation, one instance that the Securities Commissioner Office could pursue on its own. There are not three instances. So when you read it in context, what counsel is doing is more of a clarification of the pre-sentence report allegation or assertion that there are three violations which would constitute evidence justifying the two-point enhancement. And counsel is saying, we've looked at it, we know this is out there, two of those don't apply, we concede the third one. And so the government didn't, as Judge Wood correctly points out, put on anything further. There's nothing in the record, and we allude to this. We're not even raising the other two because we didn't try to contradict what counsel had said because when I was sitting there, we figured he's conceded to the one. There's no need to. This is a done deal. And so that's why this issue was waived by counsel specifically at the sentencing hearing.
Concession to one is good enough for the two-point enhancement?
Correct. There's nothing that, yes, there's nothing in the sentencing guidelines or in the notes or commentary that requires repeated violations or anything like that. It just requires that there be a violation of a prior administrative order, Your Honor. In terms of Howard, should the court find that there was merely a forfeiture of the issue or instead of a waiver, critical question is, what does offense mean? Is it the offense of conviction, or is it something broader than that which would include relevant conduct? And as pointed out in the brief, and as I'm sure you're all aware, offense in the sentencing guidelines is defined more broadly to include relevant conduct. And in this case, it's at Record 68 in the Statement of Reasons. Judge Shabazz says, another two levels are added because the defendant committed some of the relevant conduct in violation of an administrative order entered by the state of Wisconsin on or about October 28, 1999. So he specifically references relevant conduct, not offensive conviction.
Right. And so you think the Howard court just missed this? Because, frankly, reading the account in Howard, it looks like the government happily would have argued that that was relevant conduct, too.
Well, I think that in
how continued transfers that he was making.
I don't have the PSR, of course, from Howard, but if you look at Howard, what happens is there is a person who fraudulently signs the name so he can become a co-executor of the estate. Then the mail fraud occurs, and as I read Howard, all of the money is transferred down to the accounts in this other account in Florida. Once those transfers had occurred, then there was a order put in place by the securities office, whoever the state official was.
I thought the probate court or somebody.
Right, it was the probate court, Your Honor. And after that, as I read it, the money had already been sitting there, and then he continued to transfer to his own personal accounts. That, in my view, if they had treated it as relevant conduct, would be, in a sense, double counting because the money or the wire already occurred, which included that money, and so it couldn't be relevant conduct. It was simply a bookkeeping exercise, but he was essentially just transferring it that one from one account to another. And so I don't think that would be relevant conduct. And so for that reason, the decision focused on the question of offense of conviction. Mm-hmm. And I think our case is different because in our case you have a plea, first of all, and it was to a money laundering count. But then you also have a whole course of activity that's going on, and it's set out in some detail in the PSR in this case, where Mr. Yazel was defrauding numerous individuals, giving them various explanations as to what he was doing. He had a lot of different things that he was trying to do, but essentially he was taking the money, investing in this colossal home west of Madison. He wanted to then basically have this huge monstrosity paid for free and clear, leverage that with loans to try and do deals in Iowa for the golf course and in Eau Claire for the shopping mall. And that's for the Robertsons, who had originally given him some money. They thought investing it. That money, I believe, went into the home. He comes back to them later, and at that point he's trying to work a deal with this golf course in Iowa.
Did people actually sign these 2002 letters that are part of the government's obstruction point?
There were people that signed letters even after the fact, even after the indictment, Your Honor, that said, I always intended it to be a loan, or it was a gift, or they had various ways of phrasing it. I don't know, this isn't the record, but my own speculation is they had lost a significant amount of money. They were just praying to God they would somehow get it back, and they were
write letters in support of him, and they...
There were some of the investors, Your Honor.
It is not unusual.
There were a couple of them, and that's referenced in the sentencing transcript. There were actually a few of them who did continue to write letters of support. Even the person who lost the most money, Dr. Langheim.
$2.5 million.
Correct.
A lot of money.
A lot of money.
Right.
Even he sort of vacillated.
Didn't want him to go to prison.
Yeah, it was, well, he would
so he could stay out.
He would vacillate to some extent. Let's just leave it at that. And that's not in the record here, but to answer your question, yes.
I've been there. Not asking people to stay out of prison. Sentencing people who had this.
Understood. And briefly, just with respect to Booker on the third prong, if the court does reach that and looks at it, the court will see that Judge Shabazz sentenced him 5 months short of the top of the range, and he basically did that because he felt that, or he explains that he needs to leave some room near the top since this was about a $3.6 or $4 million scheme, and I think the range goes up to $7 million. But the court notes basically something like, notwithstanding this court's view that of the leniency of the sentencing guidelines, and sort of intimating that he might go higher. Certainly there's nothing in the record to suggest he would go lower, and so the defendant here in this particular case cannot meet that third prong.
Yeah, that was a plea to one count out of 26, was it?
Well, there were more counts in the total indictment, but yes, of the money laundering, if I recall off the top of my head, one of 26 money laundering counts. Unless there are any further questions, that's all I have.
Thank you. Mr. McGowan, anything further?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, I don't believe that the Howard case would have included any kind of double counting because of the money in the act. The two-point adjustment is simply for the act of violating a judicial order. It has nothing to do with money. So it would have been applicable, I believe, in the Howard case anyway. Those are my comments. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thanks again to both counsel. We now go to the last case for the day.